Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you put it on your iPod or any type of mobile device or your computer and click play. Today, we have an excellent show as we talk about the world of processing ESI, and it's funny. This is the first show of our 90-plus shows we've done on ESI Bytes that we've done on processing, and it's literally one of the first steps in the EDERM model. So we're going to talk about, you know, what's going on in the space, why it's important, what can go wrong, trends in processing, and admittedly, it's not the sexiest space in the EDRM model, but it's pretty important. Done incorrectly, it can not only feel like a waste of money, but it can really mess up a project and put it behind the eight ball. With all the new tools out there, law firms attempting some processing, and lots of focus on early case assessment, it makes more and more sense to lift up the rocks and explore the messy world of processing further. So for this show, we've got really an outstanding panel. The first panelist, Bill Johnson's the CEO of Technology Concepts and Design Incorporated, also known as TCDI. He's a true pioneer in the electronic discovery world. He graduated from the University of Maryland in 1980 with a degree in architecture, but then Bill got into computer programming in the early stages of computer-aided design. From there, he moved into large-scale database engineering with a focus on large text databases. And during the early years, he focused on user interface engineering, including interfaces and database design for one of the first online transcript databases used in litigation, and a Supreme Court Reporter online service for BNA. Bill then formed TCDI with partner Jerry Etherly in 1988. Their early work focused on the development of databases used to track the documents generated during negotiations of various arms control treaties for the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, now part of the Department of State. These databases held full-text copies of the message traffic, which directs the negotiation teams. For any given treaty, a number of messages and documents tracked number in the hundreds of thousands. Using similar technology, TCDA launched into the litigation support projects in 1990. Their early focus was on online system design for paper-based discovery, including some of the first publicly available websites created during the tobacco litigation. TCDI pioneered the use of web technology for the creation of case management systems for large-scale product liability litigation. One of the pioneers in the processing of ESI, Bill's the architect of discovery workflow, TCDI's highly scalable processing platform for high-volume ESI processing. Our second panelist is Tim Opsitnik, who's senior partner and general counsel at Juranov. Juranov's consulting practice focuses on the application of technology solutions to challenging litigation demands of law firms and their clients, including the development of litigation and document management systems, document and electronic data warehousing, electronic discovery processing and consulting, electronic risk management consulting, and computer forensics. Juranov's client base include United States and international law firms and companies. Tim's currently a participant in the Sedona Conference Working Group Series on the best practices for electronic document retention and production, and a contributor to the working group's publication, The Sedona Principles, Best Practices, Recommendations, and Principles Addressing Electronic Document Production, and a contributor and editor to the publication, The Sedona Guidelines, Best Practices, Guidelines, and Commentary for Managing Information and Records in the Electronic Age. He's also a contributor to the Information Security for Lawyers and Law Firms, written by the Information Security Committee of the Section of Science and Technology Law of the ABA and the Law Practice Management Section. Tim has done many, many programs and presentations around the country. He's also a big supporter of ESI Bytes. Tim, glad to have you on the show. The third panelist is Sal Mancuso, who's from the New York City-based law firm of Wilkie, Farr & Gallagher. Sal has been working in the realm of litigation support for over 20 years. His career consists of both law firm and vendor experience. He has achieved a lot of success in establishing and restructuring litigation support departments of various law firms. He's a recognized leader in the area of litigation support, strategic and effective project management, record retention, and e-discovery. In addition, the reason he's on the show is he's evaluated over 40 data processing systems since 2006. The results of which are used so that he can effectively outsource and manage the processing of ESI. So a diverse team. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. And first of all, for Bill and Sal, how did you first become involved with the processing ESI, and also Tim, since it's about processing ESI?
I'll go first. Yeah, we basically got led by our clients. Being in the litigation business for a long time, going back to the paper world, we were supporting clients when the whole e-discovery arena started up. So we're kind of led by our clients. They asked us to do it. We figured out how to do it and got into the business.
Sal, yourself?
Yeah, you know, similarly, the one and only time that I actually worked on the vendor side was back in the 90s, and I recall, as Bill mentioned, the dominant service then was paper-to-paper, paper-to-image, image-to-paper, and lo and behold, we started getting requests to do something with electronic files, and the notion then was, and frankly, the way law firms and our clients were trained were to utilize databases that would eventually get to an image format. So if you have paper, ultimately you would be looking at an image. And so the driver then was also to try to convert these electronic files to image. And that's basically when I first saw it.
It sounds interesting the way you describe it. I mean, and, you know, how it all started, you know, trying to get paper and electronic, and now we're thinking of other things to do with processing, which we'll talk about more. And Tim, yourself?
Well, it's ironic because one of the early ways that we dealt with ESI is to print it and scan it into image form and put it into the databases, because as Bill and Sal have already pointed out, most of these databases were built on storing and retrieval of paper and images for paper. And so, you know, that's how we first began doing it. And then later, of course, it progressed into different formats. Hey, this isn't the most productive way of doing this. How can we convert the electronic data directly to an image form without printing it and scanning it? And then, you know, and we went from there. So it was sort of the evolution. And what we've done is we've paralleled the evolution of how the business world and others have communicated and worked as they began to create things in electronic form. You know, we had to figure out ways in which to use them and manipulate them for proper review and litigation. So, you know, we just followed what the technology drove us to do.
So, Sal, let's start off in the beginning for those who may have not thought about much about processing. What's the goal of processing electronically stored information?
Well, I think you would get different answers from different people, but where you need to start, I the way I think about it, the goals are driven, or at least should be driven, by the size and the needs of the case. Today, as we all know, courts are driving this. Certainly at the Rule 26F conference, we're talking about it. And at the end, there's some good old-fashioned legal strategy involved. That said, you know, while the set of circumstances that lead one to process ESI vary, they typically will consist of a few items, or one of a few reasons, one of which that comes to mind is the need to cull down data due to large volumes. So you may be required to minimize the amount of data you ultimately review and produce in let's say, image format. These are different strategies that our legal team, you know, can obtain at some level of processing, whether it be closer to the client firewall or the outsourced service provider. So sometimes it's volume that drives you there. The other is document review. As we've all mentioned, just a minute ago or so, that we're stuck in this mindset of having to get paper into image, certainly, but also electronic files into image. And there are certainly trends. We'll talk about that a little later, how we may not be doing that all the time today, certainly. But there is this notion to get to process data so that you can get it into some document review platform. And then last for me, really, is the production format that one may agree upon at the Rule 26F conference. So depending on what format you choose to produce in, certainly that's a driver.
Okay. Bill, over the last 2 years, devices or appliances have been created which attach to systems and enable processing. Do you see this as a long-term trend of companies getting devices to attach their systems, or are there different scenarios out there?
I think the answer to both issues there is yes. I think it's a long-term trend. People are going to look to those appliances. But there are other scenarios. I think the overriding factor is the quantity of data that needs to be processed and the time frame that it needs to be processed in. You know, we found that a typical appliance, the throughput is just not there for a single appliance if you're facing having to cull through a large volume of data. If you're in an environment where you're looking at continually looking at your materials and processing it, appliances start to make sense. But for example, for a typical large-scale job, and large-scale job I'd put in multiple hundreds of gigabytes, in our environment we're looking at running with, you know, 50 to 100 simultaneous processors. So you would never get that kind of processing power focused in an appliance. And I think that's really the major problem with appliances. That and the fact that, you know, file formats are continually evolving, so it's a major effort to keep those appliances up to date. The other thing about ESI processing is probably 95% to 98% of the processing is pretty straightforward. It's the outliers that cause major headaches for us and take up a lot of time, whether it's extraordinarily large Excel files or PowerPoints. And those things tend to break the process. And, you know, when that happens in an appliance world, you don't have too many alternatives to get around those problems. And that's one of the fallbacks on appliance. It's, you know, this idea that you can just buy a box, stick it in, and everything is going to work perfectly is probably still far out there.
Tim, when we talk about processing ESI, a lot of times people don't get excited, or they're not as interested in it. So is this something that can be bypassed?
Well, that depends. I mean, it depends on the individual situations. I mean, as Sal's already pointed out, every case seems to be a little bit different. But it starts by looking at the data that you have that you're interested in reviewing. You know, we always try to look at the most cost-effective ways of getting that relevant data, or that data that the lawyers, you know, need to review for litigation. And so, for example, if they deliver to you large volumes of data that may be irrelevant because of the type of data that it is, or operating system files and application system files, there may be ways in which to cull and filter that data out even prior to the processing stage, you know, if we're talking about true processing of data, so that we can minimize the costs associated with processing the data, because there are a lot of charges associated with that. So there are some things that you can do to minimize what you actually process. However, where we stand today is that to truly create the documents and put them in a usable form in a lit support review tool, it does require to get the most out of it processing. And I do think that will change over time. I think there will be things that we can do at an earlier stage, and I know we'll talk about that a little later in this discussion. But I do think that there are some things that can be done to minimize those burdens and to decrease the size of the data. You know, for example, you know, the processes have become more effective over time. It used to be that we TIFFed or PDFed everything when we put them into lit support tools, which was actually a burdensome part of the process. And today, almost all of the data that we process, we leave in its native form as part of that. So we have minimized, you know, many of the issues associated with processing. And I think the advances will continue, as well as, you know, hopefully decreasing the actual amount of data that ultimately needs to be processed.
Sal, there have been some law firms that are doing processing internally, and there's been a lot of debate and discussion on whether this makes sense. That hasn't been something that you've really endorsed. Why aren't you?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And, you know, there's not a week or a month that goes by that we're not reevaluating our decision. And I think if you look at the landscape, there are firms that are made up certainly of those who internalize this need. But I think for the most part, you'll find firms that do one of two things. They'll have some solution in-house to deal with the smaller matters, whether it be regulatory by nature or the smaller litigation cases. Something that's in place that will allow you to get the data in front of the attorneys a lot sooner than it would be otherwise if you were sending it out. That said, I think you know a good complement would be a very healthy outsourcing program that it involves vetting of those service providers. You know, at Wilkie, we at the moment anyway, outsource 99% of our data processing needs. The decision was an easy one for me to make and certainly for the firm. In late 2005, we basically took a very close look at bringing in the technology to process data to primarily deal with the small to medium needs for both turnaround and time and cost sake. Those are the two drivers that were leading us down that path. I noticed very early on in my analysis of the few tools I was testing that each system generated a different result, and I have to tell you, it was quite alarming. This led me to formulate a plan to outsource our data processing for all matters. What followed was the launching of a full-blown data processing evaluation of the vendors at that time. Surprisingly, but not so surprisingly today, when I think back, none of the we had three vendors at that time. Shortly after the evaluation process concluded, those three vendors were no longer on our list. So what we learned, and by the way, I should mention also, because you alluded to it, Carl, earlier, that then we took this process, matured it a little bit more, and now use it to vet all the service providers. And we do this periodically, only because I think it was Bill who mentioned that the technology is constantly changing and evolving. And the way these systems communicate with these different file types also vary because of the challenges that are confronted by these service providers. So at the end of the day, what we came back with, at least our learning points, you know, one was risk versus reward. For us, it didn't add up. You know, it just didn't make sense. Defensibility versus liability, both are big issues for us in terms of, you know, whether or not we want to bring this in. We felt that there was a more cost-effective way to do this outside of our four walls for both the law firm and the client. I mentioned the fact that the technology is constantly driving, and we find ourselves, we define ourselves as a law firm, and our core business is not to process data. So we'd rather go to the experts. And then last but not least, and this is really just the result of all of this evaluation, I feel that if you properly manage the outsourced solution, that outsourced solution can be an extension of that department and quite valuable.
Okay. So risk reduction. That's it's nice to see a legal analysis applied to this. Hey Tim, what about cloud-based processing as a solution? We hear a lot about the cloud. What are your thoughts on this model?
Well, in this context, you know, you asked about cloud-based processing, but there's also most of the time we talk about cloud-based storage or processing, and you know, there's a practical consideration here that is difficult to overcome, and that is that, you know, I don't even own this data. It's not my data. It's data that's being entrusted to me, and it's part of litigation. And oftentimes, I don't really necessarily completely know the content of it, and I just know that we treat everything as highly confidential, and so engaging or using a third party either to store such data or to send our data to for purposes of processing by focusing, outside, a bevy of computers at it for processing, to me presents risks that I'm not very comfortable with from a practical standpoint, because it's not my data. I enter into a contractual arrangements typically, and I have confidentiality agreements. And so to engage the use of a third party in that regard, to me, presents challenges. And I think that clients would get a little nervous if they knew that you were doing it. And then, of course, there are other considerations, and that's the technical considerations. One such technical consideration really is, you know, it's difficult when you know, we used to deal with these projects, they were 1 or 2 gigabyte of data. You know, now they're hundreds of gigabytes of data and even terabytes. So the practical issues from a technical perspective of moving those volumes of data back and forth to use you know, computers that may be out on the internet or out on the cloud to process and to store such data and moving it back and forth. You know, it adds a great deal of time and cost to the process, and we typically have to do these things quickly. So, you know, from a technical perspective, it's not something we're interested in. And I think there, frankly, are many other ways in which we can improve the process before we even get to those considerations. You know, just like everything else associated with cloud computing, I think it's going to change over time. Internet bandwidths will increase. Things will become a little bit more regular. But, you know, I would like maybe Bill to comment, because I think in some respects he's created his own little mini processing cloud for projects, and although it's not available to anybody else, but it is sort of a cloud, and he's done some of that internally, I'm aware of, and it's pretty remarkable. So there are things that I think you can do internally and don't necessarily need to go outside of your organization to get that that productive or that increase in productivity.
Bill, you want to add to that?
Sure. You know, the biggest problem we as vendors face is just the variability of size of the projects. And, you know, when you try to deal with security issues and keeping clients' data separate and processing in a secure environment, you try to marry that with having a cost-effective hardware infrastructure where you can handle 100 gigabytes and then the next day turn around and handle 2 terabytes, while the hardware required to do 2 terabytes is incrementally much larger than small systems. And, you know, the biggest cost issue for us in trying to control our costs is how do we come up with a hardware environment that allows us to process 100 gigabytes, 2 terabytes, 4 terabytes effectively on short term and still provide security. So we've really developed a system that allows us to scale individual, you know, build little compartments for processing a client and be able to scale that by adding processors. And we've gone to almost a totally virtual machine environment, so we don't have 200 separate servers out there, but we have about 10 massive servers that we can build out individual pieces for. And I think that's part of the trends that you're seeing, which is more and more sophistication on the part of vendors with their IT processing infrastructure. That's where a lot of our cost controls are going to come in.
Well, we've jumped into the cost issue here, and processing costs per gigabyte have dropped so much over the past 10 years. But Bill, why is processing ESI still considered to be expensive?
Well, it's definitely dropped quite a bit. I think what you're seeing is a lot of the higher costs are a result of real tight time frames that are imposed on the vendors. And so you don't have this typical process of competitive bidding in a lot of cases, and you end up with, hey, I need this processed in 2 weeks, 4 weeks. Can you do it? We got to get started. And that really puts the law firms and the companies at a real disadvantage. You don't have time to shop the vendors and compare, and that keeps competition from driving the prices down. I mean, and a lot of it has been that the technology the vendors had were very labor intensive, and we're starting to get away from that. Labor is still the largest component of costs for the vendors as well. But as new technology comes out that moves to a multi-processing environment where you can handle a lot more data with a lot fewer people, I think you'll see costs continue to come down. But I think it's less a factor of what it really costs to do ESI as much as it's what the vendors can get. And without the real competitive pressures to lower the prices. And you're seeing more and more of that, and as some of the smaller players and the less capable players get out of the market, you'll see that the big players remain and that cost competition will become a greater and greater factor. But I think in terms of the industry, it's still a very new industry. ESI processing is probably seriously less than, 10 years old, and it's still a great mystery to a lot of people. There's, I think, a lot of non-technical people view this technical stuff as highly complex that they don't understand, but boy, you know, it's a black box, and we got to pay what we got to pay. And as attorneys and companies start to understand what's really involved and start to understand what role they can play in reducing the cost for the vendor, you'll see the prices continue to drop.
Tim, Sal touched a little bit on some of the risk with processing. Would you care to add something or talk a little bit about what can go wrong when processing data?
Sure, a lot can go wrong.
No, no, this was for Tim. But Bill,
oh,
I mean,
Tim, you give it a shot.
You want to give it a shot? Go ahead.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Bill. A lot can go wrong, and that pretty much sums
it up.
That's
the general answer.
But let's talk about some what I see are some practical things that go wrong, and then some technical things that go wrong. You know, from a practical perspective, what goes wrong is, like Sal started out by saying, what do you mean by processing data? And what practically goes wrong is there's no meeting of the minds as to what we agreed to do for purposes of processing data. You know, was there supposed to be keyword searching included? You know, were exceptions supposed to be included as part of the processing? And by exceptions, I mean, you know, certain things don't, you know, they don't process well. They can't be opened. You know, they're corrupted, they're password protected, they're encrypted. You know, how are those things supposed to be helped? So you really have to have a meeting of the minds. And all these projects are different. Do you go through the checklist and say, okay, what are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about that? The other practical thing that I see that goes wrong all the time is that, you know, usually when we get questioned about what we did on this stuff, it's not like next week, the week after we did it. It's 8 months from now, a year from now. So what I see is that, you know, vendors don't necessarily have a good recollection. They have not, perfected their documentation necessary so that they can explain what they did when they did it and what the steps that were taken and what was included and what was excluded. So the documentation is essential, and it must be created contemporaneous with the event. Then, of course, you know, from a technical perspective, you know, lots of things can go wrong. Things don't get included that people think they should get included. And, you know, like we have all these upgrades to new Microsoft tools today, Microsoft Office 10. So how are the processing tools now working with these new this new user-created data from Microsoft Office? So they've got to upgrade their processing tools. And are there complications from that? So the technology that creates this data, which is processed, is evolving on the outside, and then the processing tools have to learn to deal with that. So there are consequences of that, and you know, they're often unintended. So, you know, lots of things go wrong, and that's one of the reasons why this stuff continues to be expensive and continues to be, you know, labor-intensive, quality checks and things of that nature, because the technology is evolving. But, you know, the biggest thing that I do see is how people deal with exceptions and how they deal with things that are password protected and encrypted and what doesn't get included and, you know, how you deal with files that are corrupted and, you know, because these things can't be searched or they can't be processed if they can't be opened. So that's, you know, in a nutshell, some of the things that I see. I mean, there are a host of things that go wrong, but it's usually that, you know, where we get in trouble is if we don't provide data to the lawyers for review that they may need to potentially provide to the other side. So it's something that for some reason does not have a decision acted upon it. And that's what we always try to avoid. So, you know, with exceptions, you may have to give somebody a pile of exceptions and tell them to look through it because you can't process it or what have you.
Yeah, Bill, I don't know if you wanted to add to that, but...
Sure, and I think Tim touched on it, but a big point is whatever vendor you use, make sure that their operating procedures, their practices are well-documented, are followed, that they comply with what they say they do, that there's audit trails on the data that's processed. precisely because if there's a question, you need to be able to go back to the vendor and say, okay, you know, why was this particular document excluded, or why wasn't it processed, or why was it included? And as Tim mentioned, it's often not next week when you can rely on human recollection, but it's 8 months when you're in trial and you're trying to track down a document, and you've got to have those audit trails in place and procedures in place.
I have one other question in this area that I just thought of. Between Tim and Bill, how frequent is the only discussion you have on processing what the price per gigabyte is going to be, and there's no talking about these other issues? Is that the more common request?
Well, go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I mean that's the request that gets you through the door is what's this going to cost, but. I think the serious companies go by that pretty quickly and understand that it's not just a cost issue, that there is a quality of service and the accuracy of service, and that where you may save some dollars up front with getting a cheaper processor, if they're not following good standard practices, that your risk and your potential payout on the back end is just going to be huge.
Yeah, I mean, Bill's exactly right. I mean, you may start by quoting the price, but then you better have a checklist that says, have you considered this? Have you considered this? What do you want to do about that? What if we encounter password-protected files? What if we encounter encrypted files? What types of deduplication do you want? Being able to explain to them the differences between horizontal and vertical deduplication. I mean, I don't want to say that this stuff, it is complicated, especially when you're talking to non-technical persons or persons who are unfamiliar or doing electronics discovery or you're dealing with for the first time. So you do have to have a checklist, and you have to run down that checklist with folks because although it may focus on price, quality is extraordinarily important, and that's where you get burned. And that's why, frankly, so many firms and others are willing to pay a little bit more to see that it gets done correctly and that they can sleep easy at night.
Now we've talked a little bit, we've touched on risk. Sal, when does processing data become an issue in litigation?
Carl, may I add to that last comment? Because I just want to put the client perspective of the trio on this call on that question, because I think that was a great question to ask. And that is, for us, at Wilkie, and I like to think, we do live in a perfect world, but certainly it's not that. But the burden of ensuring that processing is happening effectively, consistently, and the way it should be by both the service provider, but also the client. If the law firm is the one directing that work to the service provider, we bear that burden. And it is a checks and balances. We believe, I truly believe, that the sum of the parts should equal the whole. We do have best practices around this that say, hey, if you're processing a gig of data, I like to see the results. I like to know how much duped out, and I like to also see which outliers you're not able to process. Because at the end of the day, that's what I may have to go to the court and talk about. So I wanted to add to that. And I'm very happy to hear that the two service providers on this call are actually thinking like that.
Well, but Sal, you're exactly right. I mean, when push comes to shove, it's not the service provider that's going to be in trouble with the court. It's the lawyers who represent it or the client who represents that they've done something correctly. I mean, the service provider may well be thrown under the bus as part of this process, maybe rightly and maybe wrongly. But ultimately, as lawyers, we have an obligation to go in and tell the court and tell our clients things have been done correctly, and it is our obligation. But to some degree, and that's where we as service providers and consultants, it's become important. It's a very complex world, and we may be unfairly placing some of these burdens on attorneys from a technical perspective. I mean, that's why the service providers need to take the initiative to explain some of these technical issues, because you have to understand that many of the lawyers are really being put into almost unfair situations with respect to knowing some of these technical issues.
Absolutely agree. And I think it's a good segue, right, Carl, to this next area.
Yeah. When does it become an issue in litigation?
Let me start by saying that I don't think there's enough, and this echoes, I believe, what Tim is saying, and I'm sure Bill agrees with, and that is there's not enough standardization. We've standardized a lot, don't get me wrong. Sedona gets a lot of that credit. There's EDRM, there's Georgetown Law, and Judge Grimm. Let's give Judge Grimm some credit here. But there's not enough, and in a little bit I'll talk about what those are, but the most prevalent issue, or set of issues, certainly those that keep us up at night, are issues that I qualify or categorize as unknown or hidden. One that comes to mind, and there are several here, and this is all a culmination of having analyzed the results of many different systems that process data, is conversion to image. I think this is a wrong thing. We should not be converting to image all the time. Certainly to satisfy a production specification is fine, but there's so much that goes wrong in that one aspect of the process. Taking a file and transforming it to a new form is not natural and most difficult for data processing systems to deal with. And what I've found is it's the old damned if you do, damned if you don't. For instance, if we're processing foreign language documents, I've found, and this is not for all systems, specific systems, that if they're dealing with foreign language documents and they're converting to image, we find that if they're handling the foreign language conversion, that whole thing, and it seems to be fine, you lose other things, such as the rich text formatting of certain emails. And more specifically, there's a notion of hidden text. And by hidden text, I define that as being text that bears the same color font as the background. Now, if you're looking at the extracted text, certainly you can read that. That's black and white. But unfortunately, in today's world, for the most part anyway, what are the reviewers looking at? They're looking at the image, if, of course, you've chosen to go that route. And if it's not being properly formatted or processed, guess what? You don't see the hidden text. And beyond that, I think the value of knowing that that text was hidden goes beyond the actual value of actually reading what was hidden. Second to that is deduplication. And this is where the standardization, I think we need a lot of standardization here. And that is, we don't do enough in dictating which hashing algorithms are being used, which fields are being extracted to actually generate those hashes, and whether or not the attachments should be hashed and how they should be hashed. Because there's the notion of, well, first of all, do you hash the attachment? And if you do, do you do it just on the file name level, or do you do the entire file? You would be amazed as to how much drops out or stays in, which drives cost at the end of the day. And I think this is an area where it's low-hanging fruit. I think we should be doing something about it. The other area is embedded files and objects. You know, and I always, when I think about these, certainly in 2005, 2006, this was a huge issue for most systems. But today, like the common cold, there are remedies, you know, solutions that actually deal with these files. I'm actually happy to state that they're less of a burden. However, they do still exist. And believe it or not, there are systems today that can't go below two or three levels of embedded files. And I have to tell you, it's becoming more and more common practice among our clients to use that mindset of embedding files. It's something that folks should be aware of. And last but not least, one that's near and dear to my heart, is how these systems are extracting text. And this is something that certainly has a negative effect on the overall success of a project or even the case. Because picture a situation where, and I've lived through these and have seen this as a result of the testing, where a system is not either fully extracting text or it's just missing it altogether. If you're using that system to cull data out, or more importantly, identify potentially relevant documents, well, guess what? You're going to miss a lot of documents. And so what do? You really need to be proactive as the client, as the person who is who's shopping out for these systems.
Well, Bill, Sal threw out, I think I counted at least four different litigation risks: the hidden text, deduplication, embedded files and objects, and how systems are extracting text. From a technical perspective, do you see solutions and ways to prevent issues here?
Well, I guess I don't want to upset Sal too much by saying there's probably hundreds more that may not be aware of.
Oh, there's plenty more.
But there, you know, what you hope for, and part of this is just an experience base on the part of vendors. I mean, a lot of these issues you can't foretell. You can't say, that Microsoft Exchange is not going to give you text in certain instances given this filing condition because of a bug in Exchange. Well, you don't find that until you've tried processing it and you get no text. And I guess that's where you come to the issue of QCing the work that's done by the vendors. And that becomes a major issue. That is, you can't assume that because the vendors have it that you're going to get back all the data that's there and it's going to be correct. And there's just too many different file formats, too many specific instances, too many ways that your clients could be using the software. When you think about it, we may process 500 file types in a large job. That means you're relying on 500 different software vendors to be doing everything perfectly right. And especially if you're going to TIFF, what you're essentially doing is printing your work out. And in this modern world, you know, there's spreadsheets that never see paper. And now you're asking the vendor to create images from those spreadsheets that were never intended to be placed on paper, aren't formatted correctly. And now we're, as a vendor, being asked to create data that doesn't exist there to somehow look into the eyes of the guy creating the spreadsheet and figure out how he intended the spreadsheet to be printed. The reality is it was never intended to be printed. So there's a lot of issues there. And we've probably, in the past, 5 years, encountered 50 major bugs in on the vendor side, whether it's Microsoft, whether it's Lotus Notes, that required us to put extensive workarounds. And you only find those by having a highly reliable QC process. This isn't something that you can say, look, we're going to write a process that's 100% perfect. It just can't be done. What you need to do is to make sure that you're looking for these things on the back end, that you never assume that the process is going to give you all the data correctly, that you look for holes, you look for missing data, and it becomes a QC process that has to be integrated into the processing. And again, that's where, when we go back to how come prices aren't dropping as fast as they should, I think that's a major part of it. If you're looking at companies that do a proper QC, it's going to keep the prices up. And going way back, that's also another reason why the appliances have a major hurdle to become very widespread.
So, Sal, you talked a little bit at the end of your last answer about text extraction as a component of processing. What are your thoughts about this component and how it might affect processing in the future?
Yeah, I'm going to touch upon what Bill just said. I totally agree that there needs to be better QC measures for some of these systems that, let's talk about off-the-shelf systems, for instance, where you don't have project management behind it. Whoever's taking that system on as their core solution certainly needs to devote attention to QC measures. Certainly the law firm should be doing that, or the client, depending on who is actually seeking out that solution. And then behind it all are project management. I can't say enough of, having effective project management behind any system and process really does go a long way. That said, what I'm seeing today is really, technology companies such as Microsoft are finally assisting in the cause. I forget who it was earlier that mentioned that they released a new version of Microsoft Office. Along those lines, I think they announced earlier this year that they were going to release an open source tool set to allow third-party software and programs to better communicate with the PST file. And this is the kind of thing that we have to push. We have to push these native software companies that generate the file types that we're seeing more often than not to do something about it, to make our lives a little easier. And I feel others are bound to follow. I mentioned the QC, and I also think that, you know, a part of this does not need to go into the processing stage fully. I mean, we'll always need some level of processing, but I wouldn't mind seeing if you look at the EDRM and we're talking about processing, I'd like to see that a little more to the left. I think we should be dealing with the files as they reside in their native form. That's a difficult chore, I know, but so much goes on as you're processing and converting. So at the end of the day, I think it's better QC measure, pushing those companies that are actually putting out these file types to understand that these file types are needed in a different capacity, and just educating the masses.
Tim, do you see any development for early case assessment at the processing stage? And we hear a bit about that in the field. Or do you think that search and retrieval tools are more robust if they're used with some intelligence?
Well, I think search and retrieval tools can be applied at the at some of the earlier stages, and so I do see that some earlier case assessment attaches to the processing stage or even before then. And you know, we have to remember that I talked a little bit earlier about what our goal is, and our goal really is to take this big chunk of data, and you know, we as lawyers, we look at it, okay, who are the relevant custodians? What are the relevant departments? What are the relevant document types? And all the time we're asking ourselves questions, trying to get to the smallest amount of data that we defensibly can review consistent with our obligations of good faith and reasonableness. So if we can employ the use of early case assessment at earlier stages, such as in the processing stage, or even as Sal just pointed out, the stage of in their native applications, in looking at the documents where they lay within the context of a corporation or other setting, if we can approach the documents, then the earlier we can approach them, including the processing stage, to make some effective decisions about what to be included or excluded, to move down to processing and then ultimately review. It's a win-win for everyone. Costs go down, burdens go down. I mean, that is the goal. So I do believe, and I know there are vendors and technology folks, software providers, working on ways in which to analyze data at earlier stages, including the processing, so that we can minimize those costs and burdens.
Tim, thanks for giving a good definition of that, what I've been calling think before process, which is, I often think the brain is the most important component in this entire strategy, and sometimes people forget about that. Ending up in the thinking area, Bill, what do you see the role of analytics in processing?
I consider that kind of a hard question because it's analytics, content search, conceptual analysis, all of that stuff is probably one of the most highly marketed technologies currently, but probably the least understood. There's places for analytics, kind of the advanced linguistic analysis of the documents in processing to try to cut down the amount of data being reviewed. But the danger there is that people don't understand how difficult it is to get good results out of that software. And again, this goes back to what Sal was talking about. The people that really understand the data, the attorneys, the people in the companies that deal with the subject matter, have to get an understanding of what these analytical tools can do and what they can't do. They're the ones that understand the data and can think of ways or what particular concepts they're looking for or what kind of analysis that they want performed. We as technicians understand what the software can do, but without understanding the data, we can't make recommendations on what technologies might work, which technologies might be overly aggressive. So I think we're still at the baby stages of using advanced analytics. And we've kind of been at the baby stages since I first got into it, which was in 1980. It's a very difficult area that if you're trying to avoid having to spend thousands of hours by linguists up front to define strategies and the best way to do that. But without that kind of effort, you run risks of getting false data. So it's still up in the air in my view.
So again, you still see the thinking at the beginning as being really important of trying to understand what you're trying to do and what tools do.
Yeah, and you know, if you go back to the paper days of collection, you had attorneys and paralegals that had a brain that walked into somebody's office and kind of knew what they were looking for and what they were collecting. With ESI, I think the initial approach was to kind of take a shotgun. We'll collect everything and process it. After all, it's just electronic data, and now I think we're finding out that we need to be much smarter about what we collect, how we collect, what we process, all the way down the line.
Okay. That sounds good. Well, I think we've reached the end of the show here. Thank you, Sal, Bill, and Tim for joining us on ESI Bytes. Hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our shows. That is ESI Bytes, the way it sounds out phonetically. It sounds like easy bytes of ESI information. But however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schoeneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurinov, wishing you a nice day.